That's 313-845-9676.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And when did the governments of the world suspect that some UFOs were extraterrestrial craft, And why won't they share this information with the general public? Perhaps today's guest can shed some light on that subject. Linda Moulton Howe is an Emmy Award-winning TV and documentary producer, investigative reporter, and reporter for the environmental news website EarthFiles.com. She is noted for her work in the areas of crop formations and cattle mutilations, and is the author of several books to include A Strange Harvest, An Alien Harvest, Glimpses of Other Realities, and Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles. Linda was on the show back in 2007, and I'm pleased to welcome her back today. Hello, Linda.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I think that it is so important to try to keep the public aware that, I'll just put it quite simply, the government of the United States and other governments have been lying for at least 60 years about the interaction of non-human intelligences with this planet. And I have always tried, as an investigative reporter and TV producer, to understand what is it that the government in the United States thinks it knows about non-human intelligence that it works so hard to keep from the American public and the human family.
You say thinks it knows. Why do you say thinks it knows?
Because I do not believe that there is any human agency or individual or group on the planet that could even scratch the surface in understanding the advanced intelligences that have been dealing with this planet, not only since World War II, but picking up on your question that you posed in the introduction, it's very clear that there have been descriptions of machines round with light spinning going all the way back to the time of Ezekiel. And these descriptions throughout history have been in text, but they have also been in many, many paintings and I think rock carvings, and perhaps even in some of the Egyptian pyramids. And if the non-human intelligence has been interacting with this planet, as long as I have been told by people working in the government, we're talking not about 5,000 years, we're talking about a quarter of a billion years. I found that fascinating when that was first proposed to me about 15 years ago by somebody who had retired from the Defense Intelligence Agency, And they sought me out because of my third book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, High Strangeness. Mm. In there, I have a very large military voices section with firsthand accounts from people ranging from those who fought in the Vietnam War and encountered silver polished discs in the jungles, to people who have talked to me, not with their real names, but have wanted me to know a great deal of information about government operations in which there have been face-to-face interactions with non-humans that the government insiders always refer to as EBAs or EBINs, and it's an acronym for extraterrestrial biological entities.
Mm.
Now, that was the frame of the discussions when I was working on the two-volume book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Part 1 and Part 2, in the 90s. Volume 2 came out in 98, and I was approached by this retired Defense Intelligence Agency person because he was especially interested in a part of my book having to do with what is referred to in the human abduction syndrome as resurrection technology. And this relates to at least 20-some years in which people have had encounters either in their home or their car or in a field, and they end up going someplace that they think is inside of some kind of a craft, and then they are exposed to seeing some cloned version of themselves on a table or in a tube of light, and then telepathically it's communicated to them that it is important that their container body keep going on this planet, and that they have, it could be everything from some sort of rheumatic fever that has damaged the heart, and the non-humans communicate, you will die if we do not do this, and we need your container body to continue on this planet for a certain period of time, and there's been all kinds of variations on that theme. Well, to me, what is very interesting, as a TV producer and an investigative reporter, assembling these kinds of reports with drawings from, say, in Glimpses Volume 2, I think there's six of these cases represented with drawings and quite in depth. And then to be sought out by somebody who worked for the United States government and could prove that they had to me and wanted to talk to me specifically about that section of the book because they knew about the resurrection technology. They know that we are dealing with advanced intelligences that have the ability to preserve, well, to create cloned life containers, preserve them in some kind of tubes of light, then project the life force into these containers, set them on our planet and maybe many other planets. But along with all of this, which is very difficult, obviously, to prove, just like everything else in the human abduction syndrome, you only have the eyewitness reports, but they don't have any proof. They don't have the non-humans, the craft, the tube technology. They don't have any of the physicalness of it. The human abduction syndrome is like trying to pick up mercury. You are dealing with human minds and what they say.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the Defense Intelligence Agency man talking to me was extremely valuable, I thought, because he was talking to me about his firsthand knowledge of the resurrection technology, the implications of it, and his attempt, along with others in our government, to try to understand what is the precise agenda of advanced intelligences that can move point to point in space-time in this universe and have technologies in which they can create any cloned container that they want and insert into those cloned containers some kind of life force which can then be monitored, uploaded, downloaded. Now, this may seem like a heavy way to start out this program, but I'm trying to get to the point that I've been trying to understand what the government of the United States and other governments have felt was absolutely so important to cover up and lie for 60 years, a policy of denial in the interest of national security set in motion by a classified executive order under Harry S. Truman and still in effect as we speak in 2011. what in the world could governments think that they know and be so afraid of the consequences to the human family that they would perpetuate over a half century of lies that I personally think are the corrupting cancer in the United States of America.
Definitely.
We have had a government since World War II when we were a strong nation that has built itself up over the last six decades, lying, 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 with all kinds of black programs trying to back engineer what in their own documents that have been leaked to me and to others says that they have been trying to back engineer extraterrestrial biological entity technology to try to get it into American corporations, patented, so it's never accessible to Freedom of Information Act or Congress or anything else. Mm. As long as these government handlers of the extraterrestrial secret can continue to put everything that's valuable inside of private American corporations, then the taxpayer, the voter, Congress, they don't have access to that information. And that is precisely what U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso wrote in his book the day after Roswell, 8 months before he died in 1998, mm-hmm. that his job coming out of World War II, handpicked by General Arthur Trudeau, who was handpicked by General Eisenhower, who became the president, and Eisenhower and Trudeau, two generals in World War II, had known and respected each other very much. And when Eisenhower became president, he handpicked General Arthur Trudeau, the only serving Army person of an executive rank at the time who had a Ph.D., and General Trudeau had a Ph.D. in engineering. And so President Eisenhower wanted that man, that specific man, that he trusted in the Army with a Ph.D. in engineering to be the first director of research and development in the Pentagon under the Army and reporting directly to President Eisenhower. And General Arthur Trudeau had known Philip J. Corso in the Italian campaign during World War II, and they were very good friends, and so General Arthur Trudeau handpicked Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso. And that book, The Day After Roswell, even though it was commercialized through a New York publishing house, the content in it, I spent hours and hours privately talking with Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso about the content in his book that included government knowledge about the human abduction syndrome, about extraterrestrial biological entities being the perpetrators of worldwide animal mutilations for decades, and that his job in the Pentagon for General Trudeau was to hand carry selected extraterrestrial technology and artifacts to various corporations, such as Corning Glass and others, where there could be some kind of precise science, as good as it could be at the time, trying to figure out what these objects were and how the United States could back engineer and incorporate them into American, we'll call it the American private business world, to keep it out of the hands of our perceived enemies, such as the Soviet Union, to keep it out of the hands of Congress, to keep it out of the hands of the taxpayers. And that is exactly the situation that the United States is in October of 2011, but what makes it all worse, trillions probably over the last 60 years, if you added it all up, in black budget dollars that never had any congressional oversight, the taxpayers have no knowledge about, that here we sit in this crumbling economic, just a sew of despond in the United States and spreading in Europe, and God only knows what is going to happen economically over the next 12 months on this planet. But here we know through Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso that there have been black projects continually since World War II in which the government of the United States hired corporations and scientists, basically, whether they knew what they were working on or not, but made sure that we would get extraterrestrial technologies into the hands of people who could at least try to back engineer them, and to report in October of 2011, after 31 years of my professional life doing a tremendous amount of TV and other reporting having to do with science and environmental matters on this planet, which are in big trouble, but realizing that we are in a government that no one believes anymore about any part of it, and that the United States is at a tremendous spiritual and psychological crisis between the American public, the 99% who are middle class or poor, versus the 1% that control everything, including the corporations that have the knowledge and access to these extraterrestrial technologies, to realize that it only took 60 years to basically gut the Constitution while everyone pretended that the red, blue, and white democracy of the United States was still intact. Today, we live in a nation that has been eroded from the inside out, trying to keep from the American public and the world public the facts that they all know. On the inside agencies, we're not alone in this universe. We have never been alone in this universe, and that there are extremely advanced intelligences that have been interacting with this planet from long before the time Homo sapiens sapien ever occurred.
Right, right. Now, going back briefly, for my purpose and probably our listeners, you mentioned two things. I'd like you to be a little bit more specific about. Cloned versions of people and container bodies. What are these two things?
Well, they're one and the same.
Okay.
A clone body is a container.
Okay.
You're living, breathing, functioning in a container.
Oh, right.
So am I. So is every creature on this planet.
Okay.
It is a container. The body is the container. The electrical energy that makes the brain and the nerves work is another system. And then you have the issue of the soul spirit. And that's the trio, the triad,
right,
of every body. And for those who would like to go into this much more deeply, I recommend Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, High Strangeness, my third of four books so far, in which there is a gigantic section that was so intriguing to the Defense Intelligence Agency man who sought me out. And I know from other people, I know that that section of the book has provoked a lot of discussion inside of units like the Majestic 12, MJ-12 people. Well, the idea that you can take a cell by scraping the inside of a mouth,
right,
and putting it into a process to clone a human being, we're not very far from that right now.
No.
And we've already had animals cloned on this earth. And so now what we're talking about is that in the last 30 years, people who have been taken by what are described as non-human intelligences and subjected to sperm and ovum extraction, have then been shown the clone version of their body. They don't know what other word to use, because as one woman extending her arms to me said, Linda, I no longer know whose arms these are.
Oh, geez.
I was in a craft it was a combination of beings, and I was shown my body and told that I was going to die because I had rheumatic fever as a child, and she had. And they showed me through some technology how damaged her heart was, and that it was important. Now, the part that's watching, she said, what part of me is watching this? Because in a tube that was filled with light was another one of her cells, and she watched some sort of energy, glowing gold, leave the body that died and move into the body that became animated, and then she was one with that body. Well, what was doing the watching of the body that died and the body that became animated? She doesn't know, and I don't know, outside of the fact that out-of-body travel has been described by humans for centuries.
Right.
And that there's probably a totally explainable scientific medical explanation for these various, we'll call them compartmentalization, compartments of being a live sentient being, mm-hmm. that there is something about the relationship between the unseen, which would be the soul and the spirit,
right.
And the universe, and that the idea that that can leave the container body and travel, which has been described over and over and over again, and is part of the Vedic literature, the Chinese literature. There's so many of the spiritual literatures on the planet that talk about meditation to leave the body and explore up and, you know, looking down and all of that.
Right.
So you can say that the people in the abduction syndrome are describing something similarly, except that they're in some kind of a big round room and they're seeing one of their selves that they recognize that is dying, and they're seeing another that's in a tube full of light, and the next thing they know, they're back in their car, in their bed, in their lawn, in their living room, wherever it was, and they are in a state of shock.
I would assume. Linda, we've got to take a brief break just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM. The only station making waves here out of Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn, Michigan. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Linda Moulton Howe, author and TV documentary producer. And we're talking about these cloned entities. Now, are these clones, are we saying that they have... whoever they are, the they out there, have copies or clones of our bodies? And what is the purpose of these clones?
Well, let me insert here that my work in 2011 is I am a full-time reporter and editor of the award-winning Science, Environment, and Real X-Files news site called earthfiles.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's in its 11th year, and I bring this up because I cover it's 2,000 reports and 50,000 images and documents now in the archives of Earth Files alone.
Hmm.
And then, in addition to doing all of the science and environmental and real X-Files news at Earth Files, I also report 3 hours of news for Coast to Coast AM radio with George Norrie every month, also looking at science and environmental matters, and usually some kind of a real X-file, trying to get people from military or government willing to go on the record, because I think it's important that the audience understand that we're not talking about people who are uneducated. Largely, the people that I've interviewed over the last 30 years in the human abduction syndrome are highly educated.
Right.
Many of them are highly skilled professionals.
Mm-hmm.
The scientists who run laboratories are the ones that you never hear about in the public because they are afraid of jeopardizing their careers.
But, and their grants, right?
The executives in banks, heads of labs, professors, police, I mean, military, there's a wide range of highly skilled professional people. Now, just I'm stressing that I am living, gathering news at as in-depth a level as I can with as many facts and the firsthand eyewitness accounts as I can in Science, Environment, and Real X-Files, and that it is in that context that I did that third book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, High Strangeness. I was living and working and producing for TV and radio and all kinds of projects in Philadelphia. And I had people who would, say, hear me on radio or television, and then I would get a letter, a sketch, and that's how that section of Glimpses Volume 2 emerged and evolved, because I felt that I had at least half a dozen important, in-depth drawings, got to meet every person I talk to or talk about in that section I have met and spent hours with.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue of cloning. Cloning has come up in the human abduction syndrome, I personally think, since at least the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And when the animal mutilations were beginning to be in headlines literally around the world in both hemispheres from around 1969 on, there were all kinds of questions that were posed by Jacques Vallée, an astronomer who has also written some of the important books in the field of trying to understand this non-human intelligence. And Jacques Vallée knew, and he and I spent hours talking about the fact that the perpetrators, as described by law enforcement, were extraterrestrial biological entities, or as sheriffs would call them, creatures from outer space. Mm-hmm. I ran into that right from the very first interviews that I did in 1979 as I was trying to figure out how to deal with all the animal mutilation reports in the state of Colorado, where I was director of special projects at the CBS station in Denver at KMGH-TV. Mm-hmm. I worked there for 7 years, produced documentary films for television, did news segments, and did live studio programs where you would have a subject and you would have an audience and you would bring in guests and have interactions with the audience. So I had a real big plate full when I was working at the CBS station, and one of the subjects that came up from all over the state in 1979 is what was happening, who or what was killing and mutilating bloodlessly, tracklessly, all these animals. But it wasn't the first cycle. It had happened many times before. These come in waves. And the very fact that as the director of special projects, doing all kinds of production for TV, well-known, written about in the newspapers all the time, a well-known quantity, that when people started bringing me all of this, these questions about what was happening to their animals, and I go to sit down with a sheriff who had had 200 and some animal mutilation reports in 18 months, and he looks at me and says, Linda, the perpetrators are creatures from outer space, and gives me the reasons why. The fiery orange lights that would show up and seem to enter into the ground and out of the ground and always leave a mutilated animal. The so-called helicopters that look like helicopters but were completely silent and would dissolve into misty clouds, or misty clouds that would dissolve into helicopters right in front of the sheriff's eyes. Oh, wow. And sitting there listening to all of this was sort of my walking through Alice in Wonderland's mirror in September of 1979, the very first time that I started talking with people about this phenomena. And the creatures from outer space hit me like a ton of bricks. What are they talking about here? And because I would have sheriffs and deputies telling me, yeah, the creatures are from outer space, and I'd say, well, you know, I'm working on this for television. I need you to stand up in front of the camera and tell me just exactly everything you've just told me. And over and over, no, Linda, no, nope. I'm giving you a favor, but I'm not going to be the one who stands up in front of your camera.
No.
And it took 2 months to get Lou Giroto, then the chief investigator in the district attorney's office in Trinidad, Colorado. He was in charge of animal mutilation investigations because they had so many in southern Colorado.
Mm.
And the only time that I could get in with my TV crew was at 10 o'clock in the evening in his office in Trinidad. And we set up the camera, and we're rolling, and I'm asking every sheriff, every deputy, every rancher, even other fellow reporters working on the story, who or what do you think is killing and mutilating these animals?
Hmm.
And to my complete and total shock, that late night, it was Lou Giroto who looked straight at me and said, unblinking, well, other investigators and I have come to the conclusion that we're dealing with creatures from outer space.
Hmm.
He said, on the record, with the camera running, what so many had told me in the previous 2 months off the record.
Right.
And that was my breakthrough with Lou Giroto. And then I was able to get other people to talk about what they had seen in terms of the large fiery orange lights. As one deputy told me, Linda, when those orange fiery spheres show up, and they range from 3 feet in diameter to 30 feet in diameter, as if they change in size, he said, whenever we got a report, we knew we were going to have animal mutilations. And that's been the case around the world ever since I did A Strange Harvest that was first broadcast May 25th, 1980, in a two-hour special on the CBS station in Denver. And after that broadcast, it was like a bomb went off. They couldn't keep up with all the mail. It was coming to the station, thousands of letters from around the world, because remember, back then, 1980, there was no computers. There were not even any faxes.
Right.
The only way we communicated in the planet in 1980 was by hard letters that went through the mail or by the phone.
Right.
And the phone, they couldn't keep, the switchboard couldn't keep up with the phones. They started dragging. I remember that first week, every day, three big, huge, gray canvas bags of mail started coming in. And there were so many letters, and there were so many phone calls, and almost without fail, I began to expect that the opening sentences on the phone or in the mail I've never told anyone this before, but when I saw your program, and then I would see that people would send in sketches. One man, he was a banker, and he said, I'm afraid, you can't use my name, but he said, my mother-in-law and I and my children watched what we thought was a helicopter coming toward our house. This was out east of Denver, and it was low, and I ran out. My mother-in-law ran out. The kids ran out because we couldn't understand. It made the sound of a helicopter, but as soon as it got over our house, it began to rise vertically, and Linda, honest to God, it changed into a square. It changed into a circle. It changed into a disc, and it kept morphing as it rose. And he drew me pictures.
Now, I've heard this before. I'm an investigator for MUFON in Michigan, and I have heard this before. And people have said, especially cases that are not recent, but they will come forward now, stories back in the 70s, sometimes back in the 60s, and it's like a deathbed confession. I have never told people before, but so many people are now coming forward with their stories that I feel I have to tell you. And they'll talk about these morphing shapes that go right in front of their eyes. First it's a square, then it's a circle, just like
you
said.
Well, let me give you another facet of this that might explain why this morphing is such a big part of this phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
There is, I don't know if he's still alive, but he was working at Sandia Labs in Albuquerque, where I'm now based, up until about, I know, full-time, till about 10, 15 years ago. And I had met him when I was working on A Strange Harvest in 79. I met a lot of people in the state of New Mexico because my work on that TV project extended into New Mexico and Nebraska, Wyoming, Colorado, and basically the region, Utah. So I had talked with people who had done firsthand investigations in the animal mutilations, and this man at Sandia Laboratory, whether assigned or whether it was true that he was doing this only out of the spirit of his own curiosity, I will never know. But he had, this particular engineer, had this idea to get seven different frequencies of black light and go up to the Manuel Gomez Ranch up in Dulce, New Mexico.
Right.
And there, I was there. I was on that ranch, saw the same place that the engineer set up the black light experiment, all of that. And they ran, Manuel Gomez had by then, when they did this experiment with the black light, I believe he had 12 cattle mutilations in the exact same pasture in his Dulce, New Mexico ranch in a 12-month period. Hmm. So it was averaging one a month. And that's why this particular man, the engineer's name was Howard Burgess. And Howard Burgess had this idea that if there was that kind of focus on one pasture and a herd of animals, that maybe they could find something like marked in black light if they gathered up, and he asked Manuel Gomez to gather up 100 mixed bulls, steers, cows, heifers, so the ages were mixed, and run them through this chute with seven different black light frequencies. And they did that. And I talked with Howard Burgess about this personally, eye to eye. Mm-hmm. And he said, of the 100 animals that they ran through that chute, there were about 8, as I recall, that had the oddest glowing rectangular patches around the side, like think of the right side of a cow's neck, and then go around the back, you know, what would be like the back of their neck, and some down on what would be the cow's chest. They were remarkably similar in all 8 of the animals, meaning the patches, in intensity, in shape. And then what Howard Burgess said to Manuel Gomez was, I'm going to expect that one of these animals will be mutilated.
So in other words, they were marked.
They were definitely marked, and it was consistently the same from animal to animal in 8 of 100.
Could this rectangular shape be seen without the black light?
Oh, no, no, no.
Oh, okay.
And what I was just going to lead to is, because of what Howard Burgess did, after A Strange Harvest was broadcast on May 25th, 1980, I got a call from a rancher down in Colorado Springs, south of Denver, in the TV station, and he said, we've got a mutilated horse here, and they have done embalmed him. That's exactly that quote. I'll never forget it.
Embalmed?
And the embalmed, the verb embalmed, was because by the time that I finally got the call about this mutilated horse, it had been laying in the pasture for 3 weeks, 21 days. I said to this man, are you sure that you think it's worth for me and the crew to come down after 3 weeks? I can't imagine. He says, Linda, I've seen your TV show. You need to see this animal. It's embalmed. Well, now I had to go see it. So the same TV crew that worked with me, and remember, this is now, I believe, because our program aired May 25th, 1980, and I believe this was was very close to that broadcast in 1980. And so I called up Richard Sigismund, who was a mineral prospector in Boulder, had also been a very close friend of J. Allen Hynek, the astronomer from Ohio State and Northwestern, who had founded his QFOS Center for UFO Studies.
Right.
And he had done so because, as an astronomer that the Air Force had picked to help them give out press releases on UFO reports that they wanted explained as swamp gas and all sorts of things, J. Allen Hynek, at the end of his life, told me that he realized the biggest mistake he had ever made was to accept being a, I guess you would say, a mouthpiece for the Air Force. I believe that's the phrase he used on trying to explain the UFO phenomena, when he, J. Allen Hynek, the astronomer, came to the conclusion that he was dealing with such high strangeness, and ultimately he's the one who wrote that terrifically valuable book in which he coined the phrases encounter of the first, second, third, and fourth kinds.
Right.
And that was the astronomer. He was a very close friend to the mining prospector, Richard Sigismund, in Boulder. Richard had worked with me in my film, A Strange Harvest, and so now I have a horse that's been laying for 3 weeks, and I called up Richard Sigismund and said, would you be willing to help me do an experiment like Howard Burgess from Sandia Labs did in Dulce, New Mexico. Can we get some different frequencies and let's all go out together and let's see what we can find on this horse? And that's what we did. Mm-hmm. And the horse, when we got there, honest to God, it looked like it should get up from a nap. And there was no maggots. There was no signs of decay. The excisions in the horse were extraordinary, precise, bloodless, and still almost as if preserved. Mm. So we got there in the afternoon, and we waited for the sun to go down, and Richard Sixton got out his black lights. Mm. And he didn't have seven. He only had, I think it was three, two or three. Mm. We would turn them on and look around the horse's body, and this is how we discovered. Right between the, let's call it the embalmed, mutilated horse lying on the ground, right square between its eyes was a rectangle that, as I recall, I know I've written about this and had the measurements, but I believe it was approximately 1 3/4 to 2 inches wide by something like 2 1/2 to 2 3/4 long. And Dave, it looked like if you had taken a perfect rectangle, the way that people spray patterns on furniture, right. You know, they make a cutout, and then they put the cutout so that no other wood will be affected except where they spray, where they've cut out.
Right.
This was that perfect, and under the black light, it looked like a perfect white rectangle. And we'd shut off the black light. You could see it in both frequencies, but it was definitely most outstanding in one. And we'd shut it off. We put the flashlight on there. We would touch that part of the hair. You couldn't feel anything stiff. You couldn't see anything different. And we did that off and on, just constantly just trying to see if there was anything about the angle or, you know, it was just baffling. Right. And the rancher was totally, by then, he was already stunned. And now he was doubly stunned because we found this perfect rectangle. And, of course, it left us with the question, well, what in the world is this perfect rectangle that shows up pure, well, when I say pure white, you know what I mean under black light.
Right, right.
It looks white, but it's got that purpley-green
right.
look in the air.
Right.
And we said to her, "The rant, why? Why is this on this horse?" And
their brand.
Now this is sort of a strange part of investigations of animal mutilations, but I'm not the only one who did this. There were people back in New Jersey who tried this, and that was to do the black light experiments that Howard Burgess had first done, then have some kind of a scalpel or a hunting knife, or somebody would have a way of cutting out any geometric pattern or pattern that glowed. So I knew that other people had tried this. I knew about Howard's work. So I said to the rancher, look, I don't know if it's worth it, but let's cut this out if you don't mind. And I've been contacted by a psychometrist from Adams State in Southern Colorado. She had seen a strange harvest. She had contacted me at the station and said, I have a gift of the archaeology and anthropology departments at Adams State use me. They will put shards from pottery, you know, how you would excavate at different sites.
Right.
And there it would be mostly North American Indian sites. She said, they will put shards in my hand, and I will sometimes get pictures, even movies, and I can tell them a lot about how the shard related to what shape of a pot and what it was used for. And she said, my work has been written up.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, this will be very interesting. So we cut out that rectangle. I put it in a preservative and arranged to go down now to Adams State, met her there, and she knew nothing. Now, you hear what I'm saying. I've told you all these huge details mm-hmm. about this horse and what we did.
Right.
She knows zero. All she'd done is let me know that she'd be willing to help on animal mutilation investigations.
Mm-hmm.
She knows zero because there was no way I was going to tell her anything. I wanted her to tell me what she got by holding this rectangle, but she didn't know that it glowed. She knew nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's really important. She knew zero. And I gave her this rectangle. I'm there. I'm the one who's putting it in her hand. This, none of what I'm telling you is secondhand. This is all Linda Howe's firsthand experience.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that came from her mouth was tremendous light. Was there a fire? And then, and I'm almost, it's like I have a bit of a flypaper mind for conversations and stuff.
Right.
It's like those were her first senses. And then I remember her forehead, she screwed up, her face looked like really puzzled. And she said, but it's cold. The temperature is really cold. She said, I'm seeing all this bright light. And at first I thought it was a fire, but it's cold. Linda, it is as if I am looking at the brightest light I've ever seen, and it is cold, frigid cold. Well, now what's so interesting is, 2 months later, a psychometrist in Canada, through a whole bunch of serendipitous and a detective that was investigating with the RCMP in Canada, and you know how you get on the tracks of investigations and other things start opening up.
Right.
He said, there's this guy, he solved 31 RCMP cases. He's he would be very similar, where she was acknowledged and written up as a psychometrist working on pottery shards.
Mm-hmm.
The guy in Canada worked with the RCMP as a psychic, and used that word, psychic detective, I think that's what they called him, that he had solved all these cases in Canada, and I sent him the same piece. I kept it preserved, and I sent him the piece. And he called me up from Canada. This is 2 months later. Linda, this is, I can't remember his name now. Was there a fire there? And I'm astounded that it's nearly the first same words.
Right.
And I said, trying never to give any emotion, trying never becoming very good at trying to not have any tells, don't convey anything to any of these psychic people, just not that I'm aware of. Why? And then he said, I am seeing all of this bright white light. It looks like fire, but it feels cold. Honest to God. Same words, same impression.
Wow.
Now, the psychometrist in Adams State described a very strange non-human creature, she didn't know what it was, at the site that did the mutilation. She didn't say extraterrestrial.
Yeah.
She said a strange, small, non-human, I don't know what it is, and it is cutting these excisions from, and she could see that it was a horse. She was very accurate.
Wow.
The guy, 2 months later, who starts out the conversation with the same questions, he went so far as to say, well, this is very disturbing. I've had a very difficult time handling this. I want you to know that. I'm going to send it back to you. I don't want this tissue around me anymore. He was very aggressive and adamant that way.
Mm.
And he said, I have the distinct impression that whatever this light is, it's not associated with anything that's human.
Hmm.
That's as far as he would go. So now, those are two people working in the area that even law enforcement today, you know how embarrassed sheriffs and police are to say that they went out and got a psychic detective.
Or right.
They don't want to say that, right?
That's right.
Well, it was so interesting that that white, glowing hair, neither of those people ever knew that it fluoresced. They never knew any of the back channel info.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if, Dave, that we are working with intelligences, many more than one, with different agendas, is my personal opinion, unproved, and that there is great concern about life on this planet. The biodiversity of this planet is why it has always been so valuable. Humans are killing more animal and creature species every year than anybody thought was possible by the 21st century. We are perhaps looked at as something highly dangerous, Homo sapien, on this planet that we could be wrecking, we could be interfering with, we could be damaging a planet that is considered to be special in its biodiversity, and that the non-human, they may or may not have some restrictions in some universal law in which they can't just wholesale come in and take out Homo sapien, but that there is great concern about what is happening to life on this planet, and I think life elsewhere, and that I wrote about this in Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, that third book. I said in there, I have become convinced that there is a huge conflict in the cosmos, not just this planet, and that the bottom line is what is allowable to do with life, and cloning and the insertion of life force in going in and out of any container under the control of other advanced intelligences that leave the containers and the inspired and manipulated life completely dumb and blind about where they started and what they are about. This is, something has said, this is not to be allowed. There is, I personally think it is like a big political argument in the cosmos, and that there are some interacting with the planet that want to continue harvesting genetic material, making clones, making hybrids, doing whatever they want to do with any life that they find in the universe to their own gain. And then I think there is a powerful other point of view that is taking genetic material, creating containers, of which I've been exposed to a government document that said, quote-unquote, extraterrestrial biological entities manipulated DNA in already evolving primates to create Homo sapien. The word in its Latin form was used in the government document, Homo sapien. That means that all humans would then be somebody else's androids. There's no other way to interpret that sentence.
Right.
And another sentence in that, it was an alleged government document, said, all questions and mysteries about the evolution of Homo sapien on this planet have been answered, and this project is closed. Well, if extraterrestrial biological entities, some faction of, created and have manipulated Homo sapien for the last 35,000 years, and we are now overrunning and destroying Earth, maybe, out of all of this, in spite of 60 years of all of this unexplained and, to me, abusive lies and silence, that only a handful of humans are to be allowed the truth, that we're not alone in the universe, the whole human family deserves to know what its so-called government representatives know.
I agree.
And that if the 21st century, if we're to survive ourselves, we can't get out of this century without all of the truth coming out. Let the chips fall where they may, religious, money, politics, and let's get this planet Earth and the creatures on it up to speed with the reality of the universe that we actually live in, It is not empty. It is full of life. Right. I'm convinced of that.
Right. Whatever it takes. I mean, you know, they're afraid to tell us for they want to protect the status quo. Is that the purpose? Probably. But, you know, like this France's Cometa report, where they came out and admitted pretty much that they believe that there's a extraterrestrial biological entities, and that America's being a bit of a spoil sport and not telling their people. Well, you know, the people of France have not rioted. You know, they haven't fallen apart. They still go about their business. Why do they think America would be any different?
But look at this, Dave. France, in even going up to the precipice of saying, look, we're convinced there are extraterrestrials, and we don't know why the United States sits on this information. It didn't change anything in the global politic. The geopolitical territorial wars are the same. There's nothing that has moved the governments. Jim Mars, Whitley Strieber, Rich Dolan, on and on and on. There is a group of us who have for a very long time thought that by getting the truth from military people, the truth from government insiders, getting the truth from people who were eyewitnesses and often with photographic and videotape evidence, that it would leverage open, that in a democracy, I know it's not, I understand cynically now, this is no longer a democracy, but we thought that a government of the people, by the people, and for the people,
right,
that we would have the ability in 50 years or 30 years or how long each of us has been working, Stanton's been in this almost 50 years, is that we would be able to leverage open the truth.
Right.
And it's so clear. Corporations and the American government are joined at the hip.
Oh,
it
tell me
about it. It is a fascist nation. And now the corporations and the government do not want to lose their money flow. They don't want to lose their political control. And so the lies continue with thousands of feet deep of lies to the citizenry who clearly have been dismissed. We don't count. The only thing they want American citizens to do is not protest, keep their mouths shut, pay taxes.
I hear you. We only got a minute left, but I wanted to ask you a real quick question. Did you find chemicals in that body and then that horse to that kept it so well preserved?
No, we never did anything. It's very, very expensive to do lab tests on tissue. And I've never found a veterinarian pathologist or a lab anywhere that would take tissue that was older than 36 hours after death. So you have to have either a medical friend who will do it out of the curiosity of their mind or the goodness of their heart on some of these cases. But at least we were able to work with that black light.
And did you find...
The one thing I hope that you and your listeners will do is go to earthfiles.com, my news website, every day if you can, because I really, truly am trying to honor the pressure of fact in science, environment, and real X-Files. And I think that some of the most valuable accounts on the record in the world are at EarthFiles now.
EarthFiles.com. Okay, Linda Moulton Howe, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And let's not wait 3-4 years to get back together again, okay?
Yeah, we ought to do it in 2012 again. That's a serious year.
Let's do it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Linda. Have a good one.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And if you have any, if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on the forum button on the homepage. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, UFOImplications.com. That's UFOImplications.com. Please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
WHFR Monday Forum, an hour of a wide variety of one or more talk show programs from 6 to 7 p.m., some of which are locally produced.
Today turns into yesterday, leaving only words we say for this time.
New ideas and information, different each week, not available on other Detroit stations. That's why we're the station making waves, WHFR.FM. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to whfr@hfcc.edu.
The good times, the hard times, this time is our time.
The WHFR Monday Forum, 6 to 7 p.m. And also listen to all locally produced talk shows on WHFR Tuesday Forum from 1 to 2 p.m.
WHFR.FM, your commercial-free public radio station, is having a fall benefit concert Saturday night, November 12th, 7 to 10 p.m. at Andiamo Dearborn. Enjoy an elegant evening of live jazz at the beautiful Andiamo on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn, featuring flautist Willona Green. Also performing Detroit's own Ronnie Sport Coat Overton. Admission donation is only $5 at the door. All proceeds to benefit your public radio station, WHFR.FM. Food and drinks will be available at an additional charge. That's Saturday night, November the 12th, 7 to 10 p.m. at Andiamo, Dearborn. For more information, call 313-845-9676. That's 313-845-9676.
On November 9th at approximately 2 p.m. Eastern, the Federal Emergency Management Agency will conduct a nationwide test of the emergency alert system. It will be heard on radio and seen on local cable and satellite TV. As the federal, state, tribal, territorial, and local governments prepare for and test their capabilities, this event serves as a reminder that everyone should establish an emergency preparedness kit and emergency plan for themselves, their families, communities, and businesses. Visit FEMA.gov for more information.